Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Rosemary Shinohara of the Anchorage Daily News, and Scott Christensen of the Anchorage Press. Paul, big story here in all of the United States about sexual abuse in the Boy Scouts. There are several thousand scoutmasters who are involved. This abuse has been known, maybe not the level of it, for some time, but it's still pretty shocking.
It is shocking. We only know about it because of a lawsuit filed against the scouts in 2010. Those were ordered, I guess they came as part of the interrogatory process during the lawsuit.
Thousands of records.
Thousands, something like 15,000 pages or something. And the scouts fought them all the way to the Oregon Supreme Court. This case was in Oregon. Fought all the way to the Oregon Supreme Court trying to keep those records out of the public eye and lost. And yesterday, Thursday, those records were released. And we find that at least seven, perhaps more, scoutmasters in Alaska were also involved in this sort of thing.
And of course, nobody would assume that the number that were reported or caught is the same number as existed. And I was quite surprised that one of the scoutmasters was at the camp I was at, Lost Lake in Fairbanks. Paul, not when I was there, but later. What is to be done to sift out people like this from those who apply and want to work with children?
I think that the times are very different, and I think also the level of security is very different in the 50s, 60s, even the 70s, perhaps even into the 80s. The idea of doing background checks, in-depth background checks on people who work with children was pretty much unheard of. I mean, I'm sure it was done, but it wasn't routine. I think to nowadays, it's pretty much routine that somebody asks questions about who it is you're trusting your child to.
And we should note one other important thing here. It's pretty clear that these incidents of reports weren't treated as crimes. When sexual abuse was reported to the authorities, they wanted to move people on or get them out of the way or put an end to the story.
It was a very different time. It was such a hideous accusation, such a hideous act, that I think a lot of people just didn't act on it publicly. They didn't want to draw attention to what had happened. They want to draw attention to the organization. It's a lot like a bank and a clerk who steals money. Generally, those clerks aren't prosecuted because the banks don't need the grief. And I think that that's what people were doing back in that time. That has changed, I think. I think now that Mr. Sandusky, I think that...
Jerry Sandusky of Penn State.
I think that that gives you a good idea that those times are over.
Okay. Let's go to Rosemary Shinohara. The Anchorage Municipal Budget has been put out by the mayor in Form A, Form B, and now we have Form B amended. This can be confusing to us as readers and followers of the budget. What's going on here?
Well, I think Plan A is pretty much off the table. I haven't heard anybody talking about Plan A lately. That was a $30 million shortfall and lots of cuts of all the, it would have cut most of the new recruits for the police department and cut some firefighters and everything else. But then they've had an alternative plan where they could tap another source of revenue with money that would have gone to the school district, but the state legislature limited the amount of local tax money that could go to the school district. So there's another pot of money available under Anchorage's tax cap that can now be used for the city. And that's what they're looking at.
How long will this process take for a resolution?
There's a budget hearing next Tuesday and the Tuesday after, and then there's a vote scheduled November 13th. And I think the budget that's everyone's looking at now, Plan B amended, it has much less severe cuts. It doesn't cut any sitting firefighters or police, although they would each lose some vacant positions.
And is it the end of next month or sometime in December that the budget has to be approved
by
law?
No, it's approved in November 13th.
By law?
Or
that's what they're planning to do in this case?
There is some deadline in it. It's right around there. I'm not sure if it's that.
Paul, is the mayor responding to public pressure, the pressure from the assembly, or good thoughts in his own head?
Good thoughts in his own head. That's right. The A budget was a box of rocks. I don't think he wasn't going anywhere with that. It was to show you how good the B budget was. And in the B budget, he caught some flack on that for the fire stations and trying to close fire stations, and thought he would back away from that. Now, what he winds up with is a pretty painless budget, with the Assembly thinking, gee whiz, that's not such a terrible thing, and he can move on. He's got to appease the Assembly, I think, on budget matters, because they can really throw the monkey wrench into the machinery if they wanted to. But now he's got them on his side, mostly. So I think he's done well with this one.
Paul, let's stick with you. Crime declines in Anchorage with serious exceptions, according to official FBI statistics. What are the details in these FBI statistics and the comparison over a number of years?
Nationally, over the past decade or so, we've had a slow decline in crime until this year. And they think this year it's up 18% for serious crimes, 11% for property crimes. They think that's because it was compared with 2010, which was a very slow year for crime. In Anchorage, everything is down except forcible rapes, which we have had problems with, I guess, for as long as I've been here. We always rank near the top per capita for rapes in the city. And burglaries apparently are up. So while everything has kind of a downward trend, the one crime that we have the hardest time dealing with is up. And it's up, I think, substantially. It's up 264 to 283 this year.
And that's reported cases.
And that's reported
experts
cases.
Experts generally assume that this is an underreported crime.
It's an underreported crime.
Scott, inevitably, when we hear about declining crime statistics, we hear members of the public who come forward and say, well, not for me, crime isn't declining, or many people don't feel safer. I mean, that's really what we hear. Explain.
Well, I think once you know someone or something's happened to you, it really does change you. I've recovered my own wallet from a trash bin in a bar. I've had a window broken out in my car. The two are very different. With the wallet, thereafter, I looked at people differently who were in that particular place, even though they're not more likely to rip me off than someone in another place.
You pickpocketed or left it on the bar? What's the detail?
And I don't know. That's the problem. But you look at the other people differently, you know? And in the case of the car, I think I felt what a homeowner would feel if you got home and saw that your door was broken in. And that was really awful. It's like, that's my space. And they just waited till I wasn't there and went in.
So the public tends to be very anecdotal and personal, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I think so. I don't think the statistics mean much to them. They know if one of their neighbors has been ripped off, and they know if their church was burglarized, as happened in Wasilla recently. They know these things.
Okay, let's stick on crime. You had a big story in the Anchorage Press, very big story, on the use of heroin in Anchorage. And in some ways, this was quite surprising. Since we're not part of that culture, most of us don't know what goes on, and we don't know what goes on with treatment and people who respond to overdoses and all the rest of us.
Yeah, it's interesting. I didn't actually have an addict to write about, and my deadline was approaching, so I talked to cops and paramedics and all of these other people, and one person in treatment, one or two people in treatment, and one of them's in the story. And there's different avenues to get in. Some of these people were on the street using another thing, methamphetamine or crack or cocaine, and they switched to heroin when heroin got cheap in Anchorage and throughout Alaska, which is apparently the last 10 years or so. Another avenue is people who were using prescription painkillers and sort of graduated to street drugs into heroin when their doctor or they went doctor shopping and the medical people weren't going to give them any more prescription painkillers. Prescription painkillers got more expensive on the street as the price of heroin was dropping. And we know the reasons for that. There's a Daily Newsminer article from March that talks about this. The drug manufacturers have actually made OxyContin and some other painkillers more difficult to grind up, more difficult to make them soluble, to shoot up, more difficult to abuse. And at the same time, pain doctors have been they haven't been prescribing them as liberally. So the result is, and this is according to Sam Friedman, he's the crime reporter in Fairbanks, the result is that these things get more expensive on the street. They're harder to steal, there just aren't as many of them there. And the price went up. At the same time, trafficking networks have brought heroin here.
And do we have any idea what the audience is, the size of the audience for heroin? I mean, how many heroin users we could reasonably expect to have in Anchorage or believe we have?
Right now, the best statistics actually come from deaths. And they come late because vital statistics and police and other agencies work together to try to figure this out. The police told me that there were 71 people who died of overdoses from various things between 2008 and 2009, in a two-year period in which 33 people died of car accidents. What we don't know and what I couldn't figure out, there may be ways to count this, but I don't know if anyone in the government is working on this. There may be ways to count how many people, how many times the paramedics revive people in the last week. But right now, all they could provide me was anecdotal, you know, as in we do two or three a weekend.
Is that right?
And vital statistics doesn't count the people they save. These are the people who turned me on to the story. It was an emergency room doctor. Some of the first feedback I got came from another doctor who called me because they get really tired of, you know, reviving the same person over and over again and then not having a place to send them to. The methadone
and what
clinic.
Tell us about that. What is the treatment? We know that there is treatment, but here in Anchorage specifically.
We have a methadone clinic here called Center for Drug Problems, and they can treat about 100 people. I think they're treating 103 right now with their prescription medication. They also have counseling for people on their waiting list. They have counseling for people who are getting off their prescription medication. So they may have more clients than that. But the thing about the rise of heroin that they told me is, you know, just a couple of years ago, they went from a budget limit of 75 patients to 100 patients. And they thought the waiting list would disappear, and it didn't. They have the same waiting list, 17, 20
Paul,
people
later. Paul, let's just try this. Heroin seems like such an old-fashioned drug. Out of the 50s, when William Burroughs wrote Junkie, when many celebrities were arrested for shooting up, Lenny Bruce in particular, and it continues to attract new users. Do you have a theory why?
Well,
aside from the economics, which Scott explained to us.
It's a cyclical drug, I think, and it depends a lot on prices. It's inexpensive now. Sometimes it's not inexpensive. Heroin coming in from Mexico has increased, so therefore the prices are going down at a time when other prices are going up. A guy named Robbie Soliver, he's a Newsday columnist and a Village Voice, a senior editor, wrote a book called ABC Kids, and he interviewed, hundreds if not thousands of teenagers. Why are you doing heroin? Well, and the answer that he kept getting, which was so stunning to him, was it's no big deal. It's like to them they were equating heroin use with alcohol use and smoking marijuana, and they knew they would be addicted, and they knew that they would wind up in jail, but they didn't care. It's no big deal to them, which he found just amazing.
I think the inference there would be their life is no big deal.
Well, their life is no big deal, and that's essentially where he was going with that. As he points out, I mean, heroin use is on the rise, not just here, but across the country because of pricing. It's mostly suburban white kids. And of those, it's mostly suburban white teen girls. Suburban teen girls like the idea of doing heroin. Heroin chic is a cool thing, I suppose. But on the other hand, if prices were to be driven back up, I suppose we would see a change to another drug of choice.
Before we move on, Scott, there was one really interesting thing you mentioned earlier when we were just off the set, and that is that if you have a works and heroin on a table, just in your presence, you have a felony. You're sitting with a felony. You want to explain that to people?
Yeah, people have they've made this choice, and I liken it to the small crime choices they might make when they're a kid, which is having beer in your car when you're 18 or having marijuana on your possession at a concert. But you won't go to jail for a long time for those things. You may, in fact, just see a judge
Be
told to go home and pay a fine. When you have cocaine or heroin on the coffee table, that's a felony. There's an element of secrecy that has to go on in the culture of trafficking that is a step up from calling a friend and asking if they have any weed.
Let's go back to Rosemary. Good news for Spinard. Cook Inlet Housing is taking major steps to renovate parts of Spinard and make some big changes out there to make the whole neighborhood look better.
Mm-hmm. They've got a big project that they're planning on the 36th and Spinard Road, which is kind of, there's a lot of Spinard that's already kind of become trendy and got some cute new shops and, you know, is very popular. This part of Spinard hasn't really seen that, but they're able to, they do a lot of low-income housing in the city. They're able to take on a project like this because the sites are contaminated and not very attractive to private industry. So they feel that, you know, they can get money for to deal with contaminated sites, and then they can do something nice with the property.
That would be like a former gas station or something?
A former gas station was on that former Olson's Tesoro site is listed as a DEC contaminated site. There's been cleanup going on there, and then the water seeped underneath the street into the PJ's Strip Club property, which the Cook Inlet Housing has bought and plans. They plan to put housing and commercial, like either like a retail office on the ground floor, and then apartments or something like that up above.
And how is this financed?
They have all kinds of different places to go to for money. And they got a grant from the legislature to decontaminate the area. And they also get things like tax credit financing, like some other company gets a tax credit and if they buy affordable housing.
And this is used all over the country.
Yeah.
And do we have any idea the timeline for these events, how long this might
take? It's going to take them until the end of next year probably to clean up the sites, and then they'll start looking for what to build, you know, get the plans designed and through the building department and all that.
Okay, so we should look for next year to see some signs of progress.
Yep.
Any idea finally when the buildings that are sitting there are going to be torn down?
Well, actually, that's kind of interesting. They haven't even bought the part of the land, so that one piece of property is still in private ownership. They're negotiating to buy. The PJ's site, they really can't take it down for a while because they are ineligible for some funding if they take down the building. They're no longer blighted.
So the blight's got to be in the right circumstances.
Right.
Paul, the Alaska Supreme Court gives gadfly Andre McLeod a partial victory in her court case challenging former Governor Sarah Palin's use of private emails for state business. Give us the summary here.
She had sued trying to obstruct or block the use of private emails for government business. Her theory was, look, if they get these private emails, how do we know that they keep them? What do we know what they do with them? The Supreme Court said, no, you can use private emails for state business, but it's public record. It's the same, the electronic messages you're dealing with are the same as letters or as a paper message, and that's pretty much where it stood. The fight now is going to be over texting. The governor's office, it was an amazing answer to Reuters. It said text messages are by their nature transitory, so they wouldn't be appropriate for preservation or constitute public record.
This is Governor Parnell you're talking about?
This is Governor Parnell's office. This is his spokeswoman.
At the same time, he has said it's not appropriate, or that actually, hasn't he told his employees to stop using their private email for state business?
Pretty much, right. But the texting part, his administration now is being accused in various quarters of using texting to get around the email public records business. They don't believe that the texting is a public record.
Well, it seemed to me the hardest part of this case is the
how do you know? Exactly.
That in state government in the past, if you wrote somebody a letter, it might be a carbon copy that was in the office or some copy in the office attached to the original letter that you got. But now there's a large part of an honor system here, it seems.
Well, it would seem to me, although Governor Parnell, for his part, when you use your private email and do state business there, those emails then have to be transferred into the state email system so that there is a record of it, so we can go to the record management system. The fight's going to be, as I pointed out, it's going to be over texting, because they say it's transitory and not a public record, not appropriate to be kept as a public record.
Okay. Scott, the press had a recent story on campaign financing, and particularly yesterday, ACPIRG held a big press conference to talk about the role of big money in Alaska politics. What can you tell us?
Well, I was at the press conference. I hadn't written anything on this yet. ACPIRG sort of came to this group of reporters, and there were a lot of people.
How many people showed up, for example?
There was one TV station, the Daily News, and Alaska Dispatch.
And you.
And myself. And public radio as well. And They talked about the Make Alaska Competitive Coalition ads, which are not reportable to APOC, and they sort of showed us the similarities in language between those ads and a political ad that is reportable. And it was sort of the, you know, if it looks like a duck and walks like a duck, it's a duck argument. What they didn't have any model for future legislation that might change this. And they didn't have any accusation that anybody had done anything illegal. So they did a lot, for some of the reporters in the audience.
So what was the argument, that this was unseemly, it was unfair, unsavory, what?
Yeah, and I think, but and that was the odd thing, is because I'm sitting next to Rich Maurer at the Daily News and Amanda Coyne from the Alaska Dispatch, both of whom have done this research themselves and already tried to tell their readers that this is going on. It's they're describing the post-Citizen United world. And
remind people, that's the Supreme Court case that allowed essentially independent expenditures to be endless.
Independent expenditures, the sky's the limits. And in Alaska, I think you might have to tell who your top three donors are.
I think that's just in individual campaigns, isn't it?
No, this is
the...
I think you've got to come up with the three.
All right, so, but the competitive coalition doesn't have to come up with anything, right? They can just keep...
Isn't that
the argument here?
But to their credit, they've sort of told us how much they expect to spend. They say between $300,000 and $500,000 is what we expect to spend. They have lists of all the organizations and individuals who are members, and you assume that they're donors. It looks a lot like the same people who are the Support Industry Alliance. And most of their stuff is about oil taxes. It's also about voting. It's one of the key words in their ads that comes up all the time is voting, 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 voting. So the idea that this is not electioneering is sort of ridiculous on its face.
Well, they're suggesting it's informing the public, but not election, not advocating individual ways to vote. Is that what they're saying?
Apparently. And I think that what Ackberger is getting at is that people sort of take the campaign in aggregate, and when the Alliance, which does have to register and tell us about where it's raising and spending money, runs ads that are targeting certain people and certain key Senate seats, then the following ad is this vague thing from the Make Alaska Competitive Coalition, which contains a lot of the same words except for that Senate seat and that person's name. A voter hears these things over a long period of time and hears them, you know, electioneering.
An example that comes to mind is all the advertising that's been done on the Pebble Mine or was done during the primary election. I think it was very confusing to the public. Sometimes it was confusing to me. The Pebble Mine wasn't even on the ballot.
Yeah, that is surprising that both the mining company image ads and the Trout Unlimited anti-mining ads have continued regardless of whether there's something to vote on there.
And presumably that's just the old-fashioned attempting to influence public opinion through salesmanship.
Yeah, or somebody budgeted so much money and they didn't spend it before the election, so they've got money to spend.
Paul, let's turn to the election. We have only a couple of weeks left. Where are we? Do we have a sense of where this election is headed? I'm talking about locally.
Local election.
the state of Alaska.
Well, the key fight now is, of course, Democrats trying to hold on to Democratic seats in the Senate. I think the rest of this race is fairly, at least to me, is who cares? It's boring. But these particular races are over.
Could you say that again?
I'm sorry. I don't want to do. They're boring. The fights over the seats that are over the people who are the Hollis Frenches and the Wiley Couchies, all these guys who are part of this Senate coalition, those fights are worth watching, I think. That they really do, they will have a true effect on the future of the state, one way or the other.
And what can reporters do, Rosemary, in the time that's remaining? We're not going to have full profiles of all these candidates, so what can we do?
I don't know. I think we go after the campaign financing is to show who's supporting, you know, what kind of, who has the oil money, who has the labor money, that kind of thing.
And it's readily accessible. It's definitely accessible through the Alaska Public Offices Commissions and their reports.
Yeah.
Right. Scott, anything you want to add here as we approach 2 weeks? There'll be next week before the election.
I did want to ask Paul about the "It's Not Your Oil" column.
Well, go ahead.
It's not my oil.
For those who missed your column, what did you have to say? You're being
quoted. Essentially, the standard argument for overtaxing the oil industry is it's our oil, therefore we deserve a bigger share. Well, we already negotiated this. We negotiated lease sales 20, 30 years ago. These oil companies have certain legal rights that can't be ignored. They have rights to that oil. We can't say to them, "No, that's our oil. You have to do exactly what we say." We signed a deal. We have to do what the deal says.
Are you satisfied with that answer?
I think I understand his thinking better. Yeah.
It's a contract.
My thinking is we're out of time. See you next week on Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.